And may God speak to us this morning through his word. I don't know what you feel when you read verse 13 of Hebrews 4. How does it make you feel when you read that no creature is hidden from God's sight, but all are naked and open to the eyes of him to whom we must give account? I guess all of us, as we read that verse, we realize how far short we fall in spiritual consistency, or in true word-centered and godly living, or being faithful witnesses to the gospel in the public square, and how often we have so shallow prayer lives. And that troubles us. Here is the God that I am placed on earth to represent, yet he sees everything. He sees all my failures, my weaknesses and sins. And we know what that means when someone can see everything about us. Rejection, judgment. Isn't that really why CCTV cameras are everywhere? To catch us in the act of sin and then ensure swift justice. I guess that's partly what's so hard about Zoom. Is someone watching me while we're on it? What do they think about my house? Did I mute myself before I told my child off? Because we know that others seeing us means judgment. So when we hear that God sees not only our actions, but also the thoughts and the intents of our hearts, then we know we're in trouble, right? Rejection and judgment must follow. And so Christians often fail to live the Christian life with joy because they live under this constant sense of the frustration of God with them. After all, how can we live for God when we constantly feel that he is exasperated at every turn with us? At every turn, we see our own sins and weaknesses, and we are frustrated with ourselves. How much more must he be? And things aren't going to be helped from this next section of Hebrews, chapter 4, verse 14 to 5, verse 10. Take us to God's holy throne, the place from which God rules and judges the world. Now we know we're in trouble. But this is where Hebrews takes a surprising turn in our minds. For not only does it call God's throne the throne of grace, it also introduces us to the fact that there at the throne of grace, we have a representative and a sympathetic one at that, whose name is Jesus. You know, we naturally think to ourselves, I have really messed up today. I've sinned. I've messed up. My father is going to be so angry with me. But what this section of Hebrews tells us we ought to be saying is this: I have really messed up. I better go and speak to my father about this. These verses give us five reasons that correspond to Jesus from eternity, then in his life on earth, then in his death, his resurrection, and his ascension. I want to take those in order to show us how we can come boldly to God, and that we don't have to be fearful that he is watching over in judgment all the time, but that he wants to hear us in our weaknesses. So let's take these in order. Firstly, Jesus in heaven before his birth. And the first reason why we can approach God confidently is that God has appointed Jesus to represent us. In these verses, there's a contrast and comparison fleshed out between the high priest seen in the Old Testament and Jesus as the great high priest of the New Covenant. And one of the similarities is found here in chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. The high priests were appointed by God to act on behalf of his people. The people of God in the Old Testament, just like us today, sinned against the holy God. We've just heard about it in the children's talk. By their own works, they could never be holy enough to stand in God's presence. So God formed for them these powerful symbols of the realities of his plan to rescue and redeem them as sinners. how he could allow them into his eternal presence. One of these symbols was a remarkably dressed man called the High Priest. God appointed this High Priest to represent God to man and man to God, to speak God's grace to sinners and to plead sinners' cause to God. Not anybody was allowed to do that. There was only one mediator between God and man, and that was the man who was appointed by God, chosen by God for this specific task. The people didn't get a say. After all, this wasn't a democracy on how to get to God. There was no voting system on who sinners would like to represent them. After all, we know that we would never choose the best option for us, and we'd never agree on who the best option was. Democracies just aren't perfect systems for earth, let alone heaven and holiness and how to approach God. God alone knows who can represent both him and us in the best way. And this is certainly true of Jesus Christ. God did not just choose anyone. He appointed for us his own eternal and holy Son, begotten and not created, the trustworthy Son of God and perfect man. God appointing Jesus to be our representative tells us these two vital truths. Number one, that God is not reticent to meet with sinners like us. On the contrary, he is the one who takes the initiative to get to us when we are far from him and disinterested in him. God appointed someone on purpose so that we could know him. And the second truth here is that he has chosen a perfect representative for us. He appointed Jesus. If you were asking this morning, how can I possibly come into the presence of God? I'm such a failure. I'm so weak. And you would be correct. You are too unholy to represent yourself to God. You would never desire to come to him. But God has actively reached out to you. He's appointed a perfect one, Jesus. Someone who's holy and undefiled, representing us to God. So this morning, will you run to the one who is not reticent to receive you, but who is active and engaged, and who has initiated a relationship with sinners, just like me and just like you? Secondly, we see Jesus on earth in his life. This tells us, secondly, that we can come to God with confidence because Jesus is sympathetic to our struggles. You know, it's possible when we see someone rebelling against God to become cold and hard towards them. But that is a surprising response for us as Christians. It's a failure to recognize that we are also struggling sinners in so many ways. All of us face significant and severe temptations, and too often we fall before their onslaught. So in choosing a priest, God appointed in the Old Testament men who were self-aware, men who understood their own weakness, and they would respond not with harshness, but with gentleness to sinners like them. So look at chapter 5, verse 2. We're told there that the priests that God appointed, they would have compassion on those who are ignorant and going astray, since they themselves were also subject to weakness. The priests of the Old Testament sinned, and so they were able to understand the sinners that came to them who wanted to be represented to God. Their weakness was seen in their own personal sinfulness. And here is a similarity and yet a great contrast with our great high priest, Jesus Christ. Like all priests before him, Jesus was tempted by the evil one. He felt great weakness as he lived in this evil world with all its brutality. But unlike all priests before him, we are told in chapter 4, verse 15, that though he was tempted like they are and like we are, yet he did not sin. Now, it's worth stopping there and noting this, that he was tempted in every way like we are. But that doesn't mean that he faced every particular temptation possible in the world. He didn't experience, for example, the particular temptation of, let's say, a married woman or an elderly retired gentleman living in a nursing home. That's not what this verse is implying. But it is saying that he was tempted by Satan to break all of the Ten Commandments, which are at the root problem of all of our sins. He was tempted in every way like we are. He was tempted to break the Sabbath. He was tempted to exalt status and wealth above his father. You remember Satan taking him up to the high place and showing him the kingdoms of the world. Satan tempted him to put others or other things before God, his father. He was tempted to covet. Jesus experienced all these root temptations that are at the heart of all of our failures. And he faced those temptations in a much deeper way than we have ever felt. Why? Because he never gave in to them. You know, we may give in to temptation after 5 minutes or a few days, but Jesus never fell for it. He endured to the end of the temptation. C.S. Lewis describes it this way. He illustrates it like this. He says, "You find out the strength of the German army by fighting against it, not by giving in." He says, "You find the strength of the wind by trying to walk against it, not by lying down." Temptation comes to us and we give in, we lay down, we sin. But he never did. He fought to the end. He drank the cup of temptation to its very dregs and never failed, never was flawed. So although he never sinned, he experienced the power of temptation. And so he can still empathize with us in our failures. He knows deeply how hard it is to endure in the race of obedience and faith. So even though he is sinless, that does not make him hard or cold towards us. His experiences make him warm and gentle to sinners like you and me. So we can come to the Father even when we have failed once again, even when we've given into temptation once again, for he didn't appoint a high priest who was unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Jesus is the humble Son of God who came to earth to experience true weakness and temptation in order that he could be compassionate and gentle towards us. And then thirdly, we see Jesus in his death. We're told in these verses that we can pray confidently because Jesus is the source of our salvation. This is how chapter 5, verses 8 and 9 describe him. He is not the source of criticism for sinners like us. He is the source of our salvation. What does the verse say? "Though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And having been perfected, he became the author of salvation to all who obey him." What does it mean here when it says that Jesus had to learn obedience through suffering and be perfected? Well, it can't have anything to do with him having sinned, because we've just been told that he never sinned. So this is not saying that he was disobedient, but then became obedient, or that he was imperfect and became perfect, because Both disobedience and imperfection are at heart expressions of sin, but he never sinned. So what can they mean? Well, these verses are very simply revealing that though as a son he always obeyed his father in heaven, now on earth, with all the pushes and pulls of temptation, his perfect obedience is proven and revealed in a way that it never had been before. It was an untested perfection, an untested obedience. Now it is a tested, suffering obedience and perfection. And so in that way, there is a progression of perfection, isn't there? Untested to tested, unproven to proven. So it's not an imperfection to perfection, but a unproven perfection to a proven one. And so this obedience and this perfection was tested, say these verses, right up to the agony and death of Calvary. Becomes perfect through suffering. It's revealed in his last prayer, one of his final prayers in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he says, doesn't he, "Let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done." Even up to this point of agony, he is showing that he is perfect. The Lord Jesus is pushed to the brink of significant suffering. He allows himself to be stretched beyond what we would have been able to cope with. Yet as a true and full human being, he experiences even then what it means to obey God to the nth degree. You know, if Jesus had failed in that garden in any way, we would not have been redeemed by his own precious blood. He would have caved in the garden. He would have run away knowing all that faced him. We can be so thankful this morning for the conscious experience of trusting him and knowing him, because God has given him not to be the source of our criticism and saying, "Why have you sinned again? Why have you failed again? Why are you coming to me again in prayer? Because you're such weak people." No, he's not like that. No, he's not the source of our criticism. He's the source of our salvation. He's gone the extra mile. He's gone to death so that we could come to God. How could we ever think that he would turn his face away from us when he went to that distance, in turning his face both towards his Father in obedience and to us in love? He will never turn us away. He'll never turn us away from his presence, because he has suffered to bring us into God's presence. He's obeyed perfectly to the end to forgive those who disobey so often. He was perfect to cleanse the imperfect, to bring us to God in order to present us faultless before God in himself. And then fourthly, we see Jesus in his resurrection. So fourthly, we can come boldly to the throne because Jesus alone is the perfect prayer. I don't even know if that's a word, but he is the perfect prayer warrior, the prayer. He prays perfectly for us. You know, I'm sure that all of us at times get frustrated with our own prayerlessness or our shallowness when we do pray, and our own often selfish and inconsistent praying. If we were only ever acceptable to God if we prayed perfectly, then none of us would ever need to come to him. But we have someone who has prayed perfectly on our behalf. He has fulfilled all righteousness. He prayed perfectly so that we imperfect prayers could be acceptable before the throne. If you look at chapter 5, verse 7, it combines the prayer life of Jesus, particularly in the Garden of Gethsemane, his death, and his glorious resurrection, all as a consequence of his prayers. See what it says in chapter 5, verse 7. It says, "In the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, he was heard because of his godly fear. Now, we've just talked about that prayer in the garden, haven't we? When we hear Jesus pray, "Take this cup from me," what we usually hear is Jesus praying, "Please, Father, do not let me go through this suffering." But I wonder if that prayer contains two petitions at the same time. Isn't he praying more like this? "Father, if it's your will for me not to go through the suffering, then take this cup from me. But if it is your will for me to suffer, then take this cup from me once I have already drunk its dregs, that I might be resurrected, that I might live again." Now, the reason why I say there's two prayers in that is because that's what's implied in Hebrews 5 verse 7, that he cried in the Garden of Gethsemane to the one who was able to save him from death. And then it says, "And he was heard because of his reverence." What is that saying? Well, in other words, I think that the answer to his prayer was that he was saved from death, that the cup was taken from him, but only after he had already drunk it dry by dying upon the cross. He was praying either that I don't suffer, or that if I do suffer, I'm raised again afterwards, and this cup's removed from me. His prayer in the garden that he would rise again, if that's what it took, was answered in the most remarkable way. He was heard because of his fervent prayers. He alone was the perfect prayer. Imagine this, praying that if you die in the next few days, that you would rise again a few days later. Imagine praying that kind of prayer. And yet that's the prayer Jesus prayed. And that's the prayer that was answered. It's a perfect prayer. So our imperfect prayers should not make us reticent to come to the Father and say, "Well, I never pray perfectly, so how can I ever come? How can I ever approach you?" Well, we approach God with confidence because we come in the name of Christ, who alone prayed perfectly and whose righteousness is applied to our account. And then lastly, fifthly, we see Jesus in his resurrection. And this tells us that we can come confidently to the throne of God in prayer, for Jesus is now our man in heaven. One of the symbols God gave of his work of redemption to his people was the tabernacle. You probably know this, most of you, but that it was a tent-like structure that was carried by them through the wilderness so that they could have these powerful, visible symbols of God's redemption plan that was to come. At the back of the tabernacle was this large cube-like tent called the Holy of Holies that represented heaven, in which the awesome God lived. Then once a year, the chosen high priest could enter into that tent, bringing with him both the blood of the sacrifices to sprinkle on the mercy seat and the prayers of God's people. As God's appointed symbol, God would then accept the sacrifices in the place of their sin and so forgive them. And in doing so, he would accept the sweet-smelling incense of their prayers as well. Now, it's this powerful symbolism that's picked up in chapter 4, verse 14, in regards to the ascension of Jesus after he had risen again. "Since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, who has passed through the Holy of Holies and come out the other side, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. Jesus, with his nail-pierced hands, unlike the high priest of old who only went in once a year and then had to come back out, he has ascended into the very throne room of heaven, where he is there permanently. The man who prayed for us, the man who loved us to death, even the death on the cross, the God-man who who gave himself for sinners, the one who was buried for us, the one who rose again on the third day for us, the one who ascended back to his Father to represent us. He is the one in the very throne room of heaven, in the Holy of Holies, permanently there as our representative. So when we come to that throne in prayer, we don't come to a cold-hearted welcome, quite the opposite. For there on the throne of the Holy of Holies, the heaven of heavens, is a warm-hearted Father who joins with his own beloved Son, his appointed Savior and priest. And together with open arms, they say, "This is the eternal plan. This is why I appointed my Son. This was my heart for you, that you are able to come into my presence at any time with confidence, knowing that I am for you, not against you." You know, when our nation wants to work with another nation, it sends an ambassador, a representative, to speak on our behalf. And the ambassador lives in that nation and speaks for us until the job is done. Well, that's Christ, right? We have an ambassador. We have a man in heaven, a perfect man, a nail-pierced man who speaks well of all who have come to him and been joined with him in the obedience of faith. Because he has ascended, he is there permanently representing us before his Father. So what then? What should we do when we are in need or struggling or have failed to obey our God once again? How should we respond now that we know that Jesus was appointed by God and sympathizes with us in our weaknesses, that he is the source of our salvation, the one who alone has prayed and lived perfectly, and who now represents us in the throne room of heaven? What should we do? Well, chapter 4 tells us, doesn't it? "Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." Don't look elsewhere. Don't look within. Don't merely seek to turn over a new leaf when you're weak and failed. No, come to God with confidence, with boldness. Come to the throne of grace and be assured that he will lavish his mercy and grace upon you to help you in your time of need. How is your prayer life? Do you think that God is always watching you with reticence and frustration? These verses tell us quite the opposite. No, our Father has initiated his Son coming to earth to reconcile us with him, so that we could come to him at any time with any problem, with any weakness, and we can be confident that he will always receive us in front of his holy throne. He is not watching down on us to drive us away. He is watching us in order to draw us near.